We are back. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are talking with Ron Chernow. You sort of breezed past. He didn't bother to, John D. Rockefeller didn't bother to tell his family or the president of the United States what he was up to. This secrecy was part of a vast empire that he built. Wasn't secrecy almost industrial espionage kind of secrecy very important to him?
Secrecy was so deeply ingrained in this man. You know, when I suddenly had access to literally hundreds of thousands of letters that Rockefeller had written, I was convinced that I would instantly come up with dozens of major historical revelations. Anything but all of John D. Rockefeller's letters. And here he was controlling this global oil monopoly, 100,000 employees. There were all these cryptic little 1- and 2- and 3-line letters that, you know, say, "Dear sir, I would recommend you proceed with all due caution," signed John D. Rockefeller. He always wrote letters without actually specifying what he was talking about. Obviously, the person on the other end knew exactly what he was talking about, but he wrote every letter as if it might someday fall into the hands of a prosecuting attorney.
I was just going to say, this is...
given his history, was not entirely unwarranted paranoia. He was so secretive that Standard Oil was not an operating company per se. It was a holding company, and it secretly owned a lot of its competitors. So Rockefeller would buy you out. He would bring you to his house. He would tell you that you could not even tell your spouse that he was taking over your company. Nobody working for the company would know about it. He would tell you, as he handed over the check, not to get fancy, so that the neighbors suspected that you had just come into some money from John D. Rockefeller.
And it was often a fairly substantial check.
Yeah, often a fairly substantial check. And so that there were actually a lot of different oil refiners and marketers in the United States who would say to you, "Come and do business with us, because we're taking on the Standard Oil octopus. You know, we're this brave little independent outfit." And they encouraged people to do business with them for that reason. Very often, the most vocal of those independents were wholly owned subsidiaries of John D. Rockefeller. And a lot of the people who were saying that and working for these companies had no idea that the company was owned lock, stock, and barrel by Rockefeller. And the boss would be secretly communicating with Standard Oil via a secret post office box in Cleveland. It's amazing that he was able to operate a business that was so large with such secrecy.
You've spent a tremendous amount of time going through a tremendous amount of material. When you got through, did you have a sense that you knew anything about this man? I mean, there's a great deal of more or less objective information, but were you ever able to get inside of him?
Yeah, I think that I probably got as deeply inside him as anyone can, and then there's just a sort of core of mystery that I don't think that anyone can penetrate,
including probably his contemporaries.
Yeah,
from what you report.
Yeah, I mean, this was someone, his closest family members and colleagues found him an enigma. This is not somebody who revealed himself in letters or diaries or anything like it. I think that what I did in the book is that, see, Rockefeller had been so controversial for so many years that the biographies about him were really not biographies as we understand them, which is a synthesis of a family story, a business career, leisure time activities, philanthropy, etc. They were really just either polemics attacking Standard Oil or family-sponsored, you know, whitewashes defending Standard Oil. So I start out actually by talking about Rockefeller's strange upbringing in upstate New York, where he is the child of about as crazy a marriage as has ever existed between this very sober, devout, God-fearing Baptist woman named Eliza and her husband, Big Bill Rockefeller, who is this charming rascal. He's a bigamist. He's a snake oil
salesman. A bigamist and a snake oil salesman.
Yes.
This is not just name-calling. This is not descriptive.
Yeah, this is fact that is documented at considerable length in the book. And so, you know, here's...
And this is at a time when you move west, and west is Western New York, really rough.
Well, you know, I must tell you, this book was an education for me in terms of what small-town America was like in the 19th century, because we all have this sort of motherhood and apple pie, and we're all sort of in moral terms trying to get back to small-town America in the 19th century. Here, John D. Rockefeller's parents get married, and his father, Bill, brings into the house immediately his mistress, Nancy Brown, and during the first 2 years of the marriage, Big Bill has 4 children, 2 by his wife and 2 by his mistress, all in this little 3-room farmhouse in upstate New York.
In a little small town where everybody's watching.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is the kind of apple pie America America that we have all these sentimental myths about.
This is Currier and I, is right?
This is Currier and I. You know, and it was wild. In fact, the Rockefeller side of the family, they were really wild, hard-drinking hillbillies. There's a lot of alcoholism and philandering and wife desertion and all this. The traits that we would think of as sort of more characteristically Rockefeller was his mother's family, the Davisons. They were sort of very straight-laced Baptists and disciplined and pious. But, you know, I argue in the book, and there's much psychologically about John D. Rockefeller that one can only circumstantially speculate about, because John Dee was not someone who sat down on the couch and talked about these things.
Carl Jung dealt with his children and grandchildren, not with him.
Right. Yeah. No, and John Dee came from a pre-Freudian age, and I think convincingly in the book that he despised his father for having abandoned the family and having been this notorious person. But he always spoke highly about his father. You know, that was kind of, he had the strong sense that you only say nice things about family members. So it's difficult to penetrate all of the disguises of this man who was trying to hide all these things.
Part of this, he's so big in so many different ways,
yeah,
that I think, you know, a lot of us carry these internal contradictions. It's just that nobody notices or cares. And in his case, he was doing things on such a huge scale.
Yeah.
And personally, in a business sense.
He was also fairly, rigid's not the right word, but he was fairly well-defined in different areas. And they look contradictory, but he was able to resolve them. And I guess it seems that maybe what seems just impossibly contradictory is just a person who has written so large that contradictions that we all have learned sort of to live with in ourselves and him just seem amazing.
Well, you put your finger on something. Contradiction is the very heart of this story. I mean, this is a story of the man who was both the most ferocious businessman of the era, who was at the same time the most visionary philanthropist. And I felt that what my task was as a biographer was to figure out how Rockefeller took a life that to other people seemed contradictory and even hypocritical, and how he managed to make sense of this to himself.
It's such a big contradiction that you say at one point in The Titan, never has so much good come from so much evil.
Evil, yeah.
That's a fairly striking set of a pair.
Yeah, well, I mean, this was the man, you know, who created the most ruthless trust of the day and used the most pitiless methods. And yet, I don't think that there is anyone in America who has left behind a more impressive array of philanthropies, or whose philanthropies have touched more lives than John D. Rockefeller. There's nobody who cast a longer shadow. In fact, we're sitting here in Atlanta, you know, when John D. Rockefeller was 43 years old. In other words, when he was just about the same age that Bill Gates would be today, he was creating what's now Spelman College, these two ladies, Packard and Giles, journey to Cleveland, make a plea for a school that they've started in the drafty, leaky basement of an Atlanta church where they're trying to educate freed female slaves and their daughters, many of whom had been illiterate. Rockefeller takes this basement school, turns it into Spelman Seminary, named for his in-laws, and it then becomes Spelman College. He was in his early 40s when he did this. Now, this is...
College has had a role in America that is just really tough to put bounds around. It has been so big in educating African-American women and the women whose lives then touched all the way down through Martin Luther King's mother.
Mother and grandmother,
I think. Yeah.
And, you know, and then the next decade, he's in his 50s, he creates the University of Chicago, no less.
More or less lock, stock, and barrel.
Yeah, pays 90% of the bill the first 20 years, then creates the Rockefeller University.
And then leaves it alone, then steps back and says, okay.
No, this was actually, this was a man who was uncannily wise in certain ways, because when he started the University of Chicago, his greatest fear, he did not want his philanthropies to breed dependency, and so he was hoping he would start the University of Chicago and that the good people of Chicago would then, you know, pick up the burden and carry
didn't.
The ball. And in fact, because it was associated with Rockefeller, everyone said, if the University of Chicago has John D. Rockefeller, you know, why do they need my pennies? And so 20 years later,
or my
he finds
millions.
himself, yeah, paying 90% of the budget. And he then does something that I think is extraordinarily far-sighted. He publicly announces that he's giving a final gift and cuts himself off. And cuts himself off so successfully from the University of Chicago that a lot of people don't know that he really, you know, created and financed the university for the first 20 years. But he
Not
felt that his job as a philanthropist was to create organizations that would have a life beyond him, and that there was something, I think, both humble and wise in doing that, rather than something that would just exist to perpetuate the glory of
Well, and he took on sweeping challenges. We're going to be back in just a moment to talk more about John D. Rockefeller. We are talking with Ron Chernow, who has written a remarkable biography of Rockefeller called Titan. Bill Russell and I urge you to be with us when we all three come back.